From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Before you decide to vote for Alan Keyes, there's a few things you should know. Alan Keyes is against a woman's right to choose. Alan Keyes is against affordable health care. Alan Keyes is pro-censorship, anti-gay, and insists on being called ambassador, even though he's really just a radio talk show host. So why would you vote for Alan Keyes to be your 43rd president? Because he jumped in our mosh pit.
Today on Democracy Now!, media activist Michael Moore. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Republicans George W. Bush and John McCain spent yesterday promoting their military and foreign policies in South Carolina, which has become the new battleground for the presidential rivals as they head for the February 9th primary there. Boosted by his upset victory in the New Hampshire primaries, McCain has taken a narrow lead over Bush in South Carolina, according to a new state poll released yesterday. Conservative activist Gary Bauer, meanwhile, announced he's withdrawing from the race after receiving less than 1% of the vote in New Hampshire. On the Democratic front, Vice President Al Gore and former Senator Bill Bradley spent yesterday in California, the delegate-rich state that will be the main prize in the next Democratic primary, which will take place on March 7th. This campaign so far is shaping up to be the most expensive in U.S. history. Bush alone heading for the $100 million mark in the next couple of months. Financial endorsements for the campaigns have come from corporations, from Wall Street, from wealthy individuals, and from political action committees and other lobbying groups. But to obtain the endorsement of one group of people in Iowa and New Hampshire, the candidates were asked to do something a little different, jump into a mosh pit. And Republican candidate Alan Keyes surprised even himself by jumping into the pit in New Hampshire, where he was tossed around for a few minutes and duly received the endorsement of the mosh pit. Today, we're joined by the man who created the mobile mosh pit that followed the candidates across Iowa and New Hampshire, filmmaker and author Michael Moore. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Michael.
Hello, Amy. How are you?
Well, it's good to be with you. And I understand you've pulled over so that you don't end up in the Lincoln Tunnel during our show and not being on.
You can't get reception in this tunnel? What's going on here? Oh, we're living in this era of high tech, you know. Just before we get going here, I just, you know, want to say that, I've been, you know, really concerned about what's going on at Pacifica for the better part of this last year. I'm really opposed to any kind of censorship that's been going on, and I've made my feelings known, you know, publicly, and I've asked the Berkeley station not to, run any of my stuff until they reinstate those people out there. I guess, are we still on in Berkeley? Are we on in Berkeley right now?
Or? Yes, the KPFA, the Pacifica station in Berkeley, has been reopened, and the producers are back there.
All right. Did some of them get their jobs back? Or?
Yes, they did, locally.
Well, it's time then, I think, to just correct the whole mess in general.
Right, although the general manager is not there.
I see. Are we still on the air right now?
We are. And, in fact, today we are going to talk overall about the issue of censorship, though we'll be focusing on the kind of issues that you've been dealing with around the country. And I wanted to play, actually, for our listeners, the ad, yes, folks, the political ad that Michael Moore has run in New Hampshire. Someone might have seen it if they were watching Wheel of Fortune. It was Michael Moore's endorsement.
Before you decide to vote for Alan Keyes, there's a few things you should know. Alan Keyes is against a woman's right to choose. Alan Keyes is against affordable health care. Alan Keyes is pro-censorship, anti-gay, and insists on being called ambassador, even though he's really just a radio talk show host. So why would you vote for Alan Keyes to be your 43rd president? Because he jumped in our mosh pit. On Election Day, vote Alan Keyes. He's just crazy enough to be president. Paid for by The Awful Truth with Michael Moore.
That ad, again, appeared on television. What is this all about, Michael?
Well, we went out to Iowa last week, and we made an offer to all the candidates, whoever would jump into our mosh pit. We had about 100 degenerate but registered youth with us, and we had them in the back of a big truck. And then they would get out and form a mosh pit wherever the candidate was, and then we had the portable stage on the back of the truck that the candidate would have to jump in. If they went into the pit, they would get our endorsement. We told them, you know, this would be the easiest endorsement they would ever get. No dirty money being exchanged, no backroom favors, no promises that they're not going to keep. Just dive into the pit, body surf for a good minute or two, and you've got our endorsement. So we went to each of the candidates. We started with Gary Bauer. He called the police on us, and about five cop cars showed up with a paddy wagon to take our mosh pit away, but we sort of got out of that. And then we went over to Alan Keyes, and he actually came out, and he jumped into this pit. I mean, backwards. He did a backwards dive into this pit, and then body surfed, and then body slammed. And, I mean, I knew the guy was insane, but I've never really seen insanity that close up, you know. It was so bizarre. And then the dilemma we had then, of course, is that we said we'd endorse, and then we have to endorse Alan Keyes, a person who stands for the opposite of everything we stand for. So we were looking all week for a way to get out of this, and then finally he presented the opportunity to us when he went to New Hampshire, where he went into a classroom of fifth graders and said to these 10-year-olds, imagine for a moment if I were to lose my mind right now and I grabbed one of you and bashed your head against the floor and killed you. Of course, he was trying to make some kind of analogy to abortion. We took it as he had got the mosh pit fever had sort of overcome him, and he did not understand mosh pit etiquette. It does not involve the bashing of heads of 10-year-olds. So we had to withdraw our endorsement from him at that point for making that statement. And then we went and tried to get the other candidates to jump in the pit.
Do you ever get Steve Forbes to jump in?
No, I did corral him, though. And I even offered to hold his wallet. I had a sort of a mini forklift truck to actually hold that wallet while he jumped into the pit. And he's kind of freaky to begin with. So I'm convinced both he and Bauer arrived on the same spaceship at this point. So,
what is it you said about Steve Forbes blinking?
Well, I noticed, in the last campaign, the guy's eyes never blinked. I mean, he keeps his eyes open for a good 2 minutes. And I had mentioned this in the big one where I called a doctor here and I said, how often does the human eye need to blink? And he said, oh, at least every 15 or 20 seconds. I said, well, this guy, he goes for a full 2 minutes. And the doctor said, well, that's not human. And I started to think, that's exactly right. That is not a human. So I became convinced that the man was an alien. And, and that perhaps, people of his ilk are all from someplace else. So that was my whole point about Steve Forbes. But basically, the last thing I was able to ask him was I asked him if there was any way possible he could get that show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, on TV more nights of the week, because it's just not on enough. I figured he might have some pull, being a multi-trillionaire. So.
Well, speaking of people with a lot of money, have you managed to corral George W. Bush?
No, but I did get to him, and I shouted out at him, and he was shaking hands down the line, and I said, George, come on out and get in our mosh pit. And he said, oh, behave yourself, Michael. And by the way, go get a real job. And I said, well, I'll get a real job when you wipe that friggin' smile off your face.
This is what George W. Bush said to you.
Yeah. I said, I asked him if my SAT scores were low enough where I could come work for him. But by that point, the Texas Rangers were moving in on me, and I don't mean the baseball team.
In case you haven't figured it out, folks, we're speaking with Michael Moore, the media activist, filmmaker. He made Roger and Me. He did Canadian Bacon. And he's also a TV producer. He is host of a program called The Awful Truth. It's on Bravo. It's going to be back on starting in May. And a lot of this is being gathered for this program. Now, speaking of George W. Bush, you've spent some time, or your crew has, in Texas territory, in the death penalty capital of the Western world.
Yes, we've had quite an interesting first couple of weeks here shooting this this new season. We went down to, you know, Bush has executed more people than any other governor, but then we started looking at how many people are on death row in Florida, where Jeb Bush is the governor. We got to thinking, well, there must be some sort of sibling rivalry going on here to see which brother could kill more people. So we went down to the execution. They're having. I don't know if it's whether George Jr. is celebrating, you know, the election season or whatever. But he's scheduled just about one execution per week during this whole election time. And so we went down to the one last week, you know, they always have these pro-death penalty people show up cheering on the execution and all that. So we decided to join in their little party, and we brought a marching band, cheerleaders. And they thought this was real. You know, I mean, they thought we were like really with them, and they turned it into like a tailgate party. Of course, there was a man dying inside, who, by the way, we had spoken to and was completely in agreement with our satirical approach to the death penalty crowd.
So cheerleaders and the death penalty crowd reacting well or not?
Pretty well until some of the cheers. I think they started to figure out. You know, we brought in a big scoreboard that said George and Jeb on it, like a football scoreboard, and you know it had the numbers of how many each of them had killed. And I think they started right around then to figure out something was amiss.
We're talking to Michael Moore as he sets the stage for death penalty, well, executions in Texas, in a stadium in Texas, as well as outside the Huntsville prison. These are some of the issues, Michael, that are not being raised very much on the campaign trail, though occasionally they are. I understand Judy Woodruff, before she was anchoring one of the media debates in New Hampshire, said she feels like, you know, she can't come up with another question, that they've been asked all the questions.
Can
what
you
are your
believe
thoughts?
That is amazing. I mean, they're not talking about anything. That's what's so disgusting about this. And to me, I think the biggest story is the fact that the vast majority of people are performing an act of civil disobedience and refusing to participate in this sham. They don't vote. I mean, all this time is spent talking about, you know, the Iowa caucuses, and it turns out 10% of the people showed up to caucus, and in New Hampshire, I think it was something like, 60-some percent of the people stayed home, too. I mean, that when you have 60% of the people checking out, that, you know, that constitutes a pretty strong majority who are, I believe, making a statement. I don't think that they're staying home because they're apathetic or, you know, ignorant or whatever. I think it's because they look at the ballot and they don't see a real choice. You have everybody fighting to get into the middle. They all have the same positions. Other than with a couple of the issues like abortion, they all, Democrats and Republicans, they all support the death penalty. They all support more Pentagon spending. None of them support total universal health care. And it is just, I mean... I was there, we were there at the New Hampshire primary the other night. There's all these French and German and, you know, Arab and African TV networks there, you know, covering it too. And, you know, I wanted to go around and pull the plug out of all their cameras because it's so damn embarrassing that in a country that calls itself a democracy, we got 270 million people, this is the best we can come up with? These clowns? I mean, they don't represent the broad spectrum of political thought in this country. It's just thoroughly embarrassing as far as I'm concerned. I don't know. I mean, I've said this a lot. It's just that I just don't understand how the 1%, the top 1% that control, you know, the vast majority of all the wealth in this country, they get to have two political parties that do their bidding for them, and the other 99% of us have no political party. Now, I mean, how can you call that a democracy? I mean, I don't know.
Michael Moore is who we're talking to right now. I wanted to go back to one of the first programs you did on mainstream television. In fact, I think this was on NBC, TV Nation, before The Awful Truth. And it was one of the pieces that you had on about the prisons in this country and about the for-profit prisons, and play just a little excerpt of it. But it certainly shows where this country, I think, is headed. Could you just lay it out for us in Appleton, Minnesota, was it?
Yes. Well, as you know, many communities are getting these private prisons that are being built by, you know, private profit-making organizations. And so this town was really hitting hard times, so they decided they wanted one of these private prisons too. And they built this brand-new prison. They hired, you know, 100 people to work in it. Problem is, they didn't have any prisoners. They couldn't get any contracts with other states for them to send their prisoners to Appleton, Minnesota.
Well,
so every day people would show up to work. There's no prisoners.
Well, we can't show the pictures, which are incredible, but this is just a little clip from that piece.
Wish list of the favorite kind of prisoners that you would have here. Do you have any particular kind you'd like to see here?
This is the piece on TV Nation that appeared it was about a year ago. It was when Michael first got his star.
Right now, check on the one.
And here it comes right now. You are listening to WBAI. You're listening to, we're at WBAI, and this is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
To transport their inmates to Minnesota.
There's some apprehension because it's like we have been waiting for these people for so long.
I'm missing the one commodity we need, and that's inmates.
The idea of capitalizing on crime, the one surefire growth industry in America, seemed like the perfect idea. Well, more perfect than the others.
Oh, we looked at different types of manufacturing, anywhere from pipes to telephones to circuit boards.
Floor rugs or braided wall hangings.
Everything from freeze-dried pets.
Freeze-dried pets? What in the world is that?
They take a pet and freeze-dry it. And
for
put
what,
it on
to what end?
To display it. Like a mouse or a gopher.
We didn't want a nuclear waste dump, which the federal government tried to put up here in the Indian reservations.
Meanwhile, in order to remain eligible for inmates, the prison sits fully staffed with all kinds of personnel, eagerly awaiting the day when prisoners will arrive to make their dreams come true.
If you had a wish list of the favorite kind of prisoners that you would have here, do you have any particular kind you'd like to see here?
Yes. Old-time murderers.
This is David Harris, the chief security officer, who's been patiently waiting the past 14 months for the first prisoner to walk through
Absolutely.
The gates.
Yeah, there's washers and dryers in every housing unit we have in the facility so that the inmates are a little more personalized. We've got the microwave ovens, the ice machines.
Yes, an excerpt of TV Nation. It was your first national commercial television program, wasn't it, Michael?
Yeah, that's right. That's
right. Appleton, Minnesota, and then you went down to Mexico.
Went down to Mexico, decided to take advantage of NAFTA by firing everybody on the show and moving it down to Reynosa, Mexico, so we could get, you know, take advantage of all the help that the U.S. government was giving American corporations to exploit Mexicans and throw people here out of work.
Well, we're going to hear an excerpt of that after when we come back from the break. But overall, Michael, right now, your plans for this election, you were actually at McCain headquarters the night in New Hampshire with the upset victory. It was predicted he'd win, but not by the kind of margin we're talking about right now. And now he's showing a lead in South Carolina.
Well, I mean, let's see, what's the silver lining on that dark cloud? That the American people, by and large, aren't as stupid as the media thinks that they are. That they actually, I think, have got Junior's number. And the problem is, Junior has $67 million to try and create the illusion that he could be president. And McCain has zip. So I don't know what's going to happen there, but. I would say just after having traveled Iowa and New Hampshire, and it's probably dangerous to make any kind of prediction, but, you know, I think, first of all, we're going to have the lowest turnout ever in an election come November. And And I think Al Gore is going to get elected, president. I mean, I think that's what's going to happen here, because George Bush is, first of all, Junior. He's going to have his quail potato moment, and when the American people, I think, see just how truly stupid he is, there's no way that they're going to put him into office, and they're going to just, most people will just give up, and then Gore will probably get in with the few remaining people who show up to vote. But I understand Ralph Nader's going to run as a Green, which is great, and so hopefully Ralph can get into the debate, or at least get in, put his issues on the agenda here, and maybe that will help somewhat in the election. But
well, Michael, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves, ask you to stay on for one more minute, and ask if you think the battle in Seattle was a Gettysburg, a turning point, and will in any way affect this race of the year 2000. Then we're going to play excerpts from your earlier programs, a sense of what's to come with The Awful Truth. And then we'll go to Seattle to a speech you gave just before the showdown in Seattle when martial law was declared. You're listening to filmmaker Michael Moore. He did Roger and Me, yes, and Canadian Bacon. He is a TV commentator and host, and has done TV Nation and The Awful Truth is his latest program, which airs on the Bravo network. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. Michael, I know you have to go and get into that Lincoln Tunnel, and I hope you do come out later today. But Michael Moore, filmmaker, his latest film, by the way, the big one, his latest book, Downsize This, extremely prolific. Michael, two questions. One is on McCain. The kinds of questions he's asked about Vietnam. Clearly, he was a prisoner of war for a number of years, very brave while he was there, but never asked about the Vietnam War and the morality overall of that war.
I said the same thing the other night. He's a human being. I'm sorry that, he spent 7 years in a prisoner of war camp, but the facts are these. He was going over there to bomb people and kill them. And I don't know how any of us would react if somebody jumped out of a plane after having just killed our friends and family and neighbors with his bombs. They actually saved his life. They pulled him out of a rice paddy. He was drowning. So I don't know why this doesn't get brought up with him. I don't know why people are afraid to, I did the live remote. I was like the correspondent for Politically Incorrect the other night from New Hampshire. And the first thing I said to the host was, there's about as much excitement here as a heat-seeking missile. Kind of makes the Hanoi Hilton look like the New Hampshire Hilton. It's like they all got, you can hear people in the audience moaning, like, oh no, don't say that. Well, I think it should be said, and I think it has to be said, because you want to know where he stands on things like this. I don't know. I think, look, my feelings have always been the real heroes of that war were the people who stood up against the U.S. government and refused to go and kill Vietnamese. Those will always be the true brave heroes of the Vietnam War.
Well, Michael, we're going to hear what you have to say about Seattle by listening to a speech you gave just before the showdown in Seattle. And we want to play some excerpts of your first TV program, TV Nation, when you took the show down to Mexico because it would be cheaper to make there and other issues. But I know you do have to go. Michael Moore, media activist, filmmaker, TV host. His show is called The Awful Truth. It'll be airing on Bravo cable network starting in May. His latest film, The Big One. His latest book, Downsize This. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Amy. And let's get a new board of directors at Pacifica. Let's get the station back in the hands of the people.
Well, right now we're going to go to, thanks again for being there. We're going to go to The Awful Truth, and before that, TV Nation, some excerpts.
Hi, I'm Michael Moore, and welcome to the first episode of TV Nation. A few years ago, I made a documentary called Roger and Me, and now NBC has given me an hour each week to come into your homes. I mean, not me personally, but my show. Although, I know where you live. Okay, so, you know, I got this show on NBC, but I've got no office in here, no studio, no wardrobe, no makeup, no key grips, nothing.
No overhead.
Yeah, that's the way they look at it. They've given me nothing, and now they've told me I've got to do the show for half of what it costs to do Blossom.
To do Blossom?
Who's Blossom?
You've never seen Blossom?
No.
I mean, you got to make do with what you got.
That's your attitude.
Yeah.
I made Roger and Me, Michael Moore.
Yeah, so let me know about it.
You never
that.
Heard of it, did you? No. My movie, Roger and Me.
Roger and Me?
About General Motors.
Oh, you did that?
Yeah, that
that's
was me.
That's famous.
Yeah, that's
right. Are you going to make me famous now?
Yeah, well.
Look what happened to him. Don't do that.
No. It's TV Nation with Michael Moore. Tonight, Michael Moore hears about the North American Free Trade Agreement and moves the show to Mexico.
They make the TV serum, now we come down and make the TV show.
There huh? you go.
You got the synergy.
Yeah.
The synergy.
You're right.
How would you say in Spanish, as soon as you get your arm out of that machine, you're fired?
Rusty Cundy finds out who has an easier time of getting a cab, a distinguished black actor or a convicted white felon.
Did you see a big sign that said, I need a cab, and a black guy standing next to it?
Meryl Marco visits the quietest prison in America.
How does this one differ from other ones you've worked at?
There are no inmates.
I'm missing the one commodity we need, and that's inmates.
We go house hunting in contaminated Love Canal.
We have about 150 homes here for sale. I'm sure you can find one of them that you like.
I figure I'm healthy. Yeah. I had cancer 3 years ago, but it's gone now.
And Michael Moore goes in search of the Russian missile pointed at his hometown.
Maybe we could just point it elsewhere. Maybe we could point it at one of the star's homes. Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet are here.
Steve Lawrence, yes.
You know, but I've got to produce this. I got to have a studio. I got to have a place to go where it's cheap. I figure, well, you know, I heard about Mexico. A lot of American companies are going down there, free trade, saving a lot of money.
Mexico's good.
Cheap.
Cheap.
Huh?
Mexico's cheap.
I mean, we may have to lose a few people here.
Yes.
I wouldn't go to Mexico.
We could do the show real cheap there, I heard.
Oh, definitely. They work practically for nothing out there.
Yeah, look at all the American companies that have gone down there. Saved a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone else like this idea?
NAFTA will expand our exports, create new jobs, and help us reassert America's leadership in the global economy.
Wow. Create new jobs and reassert our leadership, all thanks to the North American Free Trade Agreement? What a great idea. I decided to do my part, so I went down to McAllen, Texas, and took the ferry across the Rio Grande to Reynosa, Mexico, where I would produce the first TV show of the free trade era.
What I want to know is, what idiot at the WTO decided to have this thing in Seattle?
I mean, were they just like sitting around one day at the WTO building and, well, we got to go have a meeting. Where should we go? Well, we could go to Fort Lauderdale. Nah, it's too warm down there. And we could go to San Diego. No, too much sun. Where could we go? Hey, I know. Let's go to Seattle and have the shit kicked out of us. Yeah. You know, at moments like that, there is a God in heaven when things like this happen, right? I don't know. So this is really an incredible turnout, and I think that the what's going to happen here this week really is a historic event, because the corporations that run this world and their employees, usually known as governments, have decided to come out of the closet, and they thought that they could get away with just creating this merger of the political entities with the corporate entities into just one corporate state that would rule the world. And they thought they could get away with it and nobody would say anything about it. And the big mistake that they made was they just got so damn greedy while they were doing it, you know? And it's really incredible that you've all shown up here in Seattle to participate in this, and to, for all the people who can't be here because they have to go to work tomorrow or they couldn't make the trip across the country, the fact that each of you represent thousands of other people around this country and around the world who are sick and tired of what's going on. About 14 years ago, I bought a suit, and and I put it on to sneak into a meeting that was being held down in Mexico. It was sponsored by the United States Department of Commerce. And the purpose of the meeting was to invite American businessmen to Mexico to teach them how they could close down their factories in the United States and move them to Mexico with the assistance of the U.S. Department of Commerce. And so I went in as a small auto parts businessman into this meeting, attending various seminars on how to screw the workers in my company and how I can exploit the workers down in Mexico. And it was a fascinating thing to see. And they took us around to some of the very first maquiladora factories, the free trade. This was pre-NAFTA, pre-GATT, pre-everything, to show us just how wonderful it was to help raise the standard of living of the Mexican people. And they promised us that if we just allowed more trade to take place, more of these factories to open, that sooner or later the Mexican people would be living just like the people in the United States and in Canada. Well, 14 years later, we went down there again this year on our TV show, The Awful Truth, to see how things were doing. And you know what? Nobody was driving around in a BMW. They weren't swimming in the backyard pool. They weren't barbecuing on a Sunday and having play dates with the kids next door. They were living the same damn pitiful, exploited lives that they were living 14 years ago when this whole mess started. It was a big lie then. It's a big lie now. And the only difference is now the people know it. The people know it's the lie. They've been caught. They've been caught. And you're the people who have caught them doing this. And to come to the city that invented the $5 coffee, the city that continues to provide the world with inferior and mediocre computer products, the city that contains the richest man in the world, who lives in the largest house in the world, hissing Why, he's made so many people here in Seattle happy. Happy millionaires. Who wants to be a millionaire? Regis, I want to trade Regis for Bill Clinton. I can't think of a better place than Seattle for this event. And for us to go out there tomorrow and in the coming days, make our voices heard, to educate people about what this is really about and what's happening, what's going on. You know they're on the run here. You know, I think they feel that they've already lost, and that's a real accomplishment to all of us here. They've lost this round. Because these people who are so smart and so rich have not been able to articulate their message. The problem is that they still run the world, and they're still hell-bent on making sure that that gap grows between rich and poor. And it is absolute. I can't think of a better place than to be here in the hometown of the richest man in the world, a man whose assets equal the poorest 100 million Americans. 100 million Americans, their assets equal the assets of one man, Bill Gates. You know, when they look back on this period of history, they'll wonder how the people allowed this kind of greed to take place and to continue for so long. And I was thinking about this on the plane here tonight, that we really are celebrating now, next year, the 20th consecutive year of the Reagan administration. He left, but it didn't leave. It came in different forms: Bush, Clinton, Gore, Bradley, McCain, Tweedledee, Tweedledum, Tweedledummer. But it's the same damn thing. You know, the revolution really is already taking place. This is just the vocal, visible end of it. But if you travel the country and if you talk to people and you see what's going on, they're pissed as hell. They've had it. They're not going to take it anymore. They don't get much of a chance to voice their concerns. If they live in Minnesota, they get to say, "Fuck you," by electing a professional wrestler for governor. You know? I mean, if the people are given a chance to say, "Fuck you," to the system, they'll take that chance anytime they're given it. But they don't get it very often. And one of the sad parts of the system is that we're going to go through another election next year with nobody to vote for. No. I'm here to officially announce that I'm a non-candidate, and I'll not be running on January 24th and in Iowa, and January 31st in New Hampshire. I'll also not be running at the $1,000 a plate dinner on December 16th in Des Moines. But there's Ralph! We do. We need a line on the ballot that says none of the above. You know, if none of the above was on the ballot, I think it would win in most elections, and we'd have the largest turnout ever. Because then there would be something to vote for. It's really pathetic. Well, we've kept everybody here long enough, and we got to get up early tomorrow. There's a lot going on. Try and snag a few of your friends and neighbors and coworkers to join us tomorrow as we get out there and make our voices heard and essentially shut down the city of Seattle and let all these corporations know, here we come. Their day is over. Their greed is over. The people of Seattle and the people who have come to join them have taken a stand. We're not going to take it anymore. We're taking back this country. We're putting it in our hands. It's still a democracy the last time I checked. So let's get it back in our hands. Let's get out there and let them know how we feel about what's going on and that we're not going to take this anymore. So I'll see you tomorrow out there. Let's get up. Let's do our job. Thank you for coming, Seattle!
Let's get the caffeine in you. Pump yourself with that caffeine and get out there tomorrow. Have a good time. Take care. Good night.
Michael Moore, media activist, filmmaker, and TV host. His program is called The Awful Truth. It airs on Bravo Network beginning in May. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and, well, this is definitely a strange scene because I am sitting with Kathy Kelly, who is in the 18th day of a hunger fast, and we're sitting in the local country kitchen in La Crosse, Wisconsin, having both been invited to Viterbo College, which is run by an order of nuns called the Nuns of Perpetual, well, I was saying motion, but I think they are in perpetual motion, but they are the Nuns of Perpetual Adoration. And they have been praying around the clock since
1878.
Wait, tell me again, Sister Anita.
Since 1878.
And you've never stopped your prayer. And where is the prayer taking place?
The prayer takes place in our Chapel of Adoration. It's a part of our chapel.
And what are you praying for?
We're praying for the world, for the city, for whoever and whatever needs to be prayed for.
And Viterbo, what is Viterbo College named for?
Viterbo College is named from a small city in Italy called Viterbo. The congregation of sisters that sponsor the college are the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, and St. Rose of Viterbo is their mother house. St. Rose Convent, Viterbo College. Mm.
And this is a college of about 1,200 people, also in the town of La Crosse's University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, where Democracy Now! Is going to broadcast from. But, Kathy Kelly, I am feeling guilty because we're sitting in the country kitchen and you're in the 18th day of your juice fast, but I'm glad you got a chance to get out of Washington for a few minutes, Washington, D.C., and talk to people who are involved in a conference, these students, for a number of days on confronting evil. Kathy Kelly is the co-director of Voices in the Wilderness, which is a Chicago-based group that has been going to Iraq now since the Gulf War, protesting the sanctions against Iraq.
Hi, Amy. Well, it's certainly good to see you here, and also to have heard the students and you tonight in an exchange that I really found riveting all the way through.
Well, I'm amazed you could stay up, considering you haven't eaten in 18 days. But quite seriously, why are you on this fast?
Well, you know, we've tried so many different means. The Voices in the Wilderness campaign in 1996 started with going over to Iraq in open and public violation of the economic sanctions. And we know that the information we come back with about the suffering, the starvation, the harm being done to an entire generation of Iraqi children is something that should be shouted out to the United States public. We've gone on long marches, we've vigiled, we've visited with Congress people, we've given countless talks all across the country, we've been told that we're in violation of the United States law, so we've tinkered with many different means of civil disobedience and nonviolence. And quite frankly, we decided to undertake this fast because we need to, in a sense, drop out of being comfortable within the rogue superpower. We're living right now in a country whose arrogance is sowing danger all around this world, and we've seen it firsthand and the way that it affects Iraqi children. And we want to drop out of business as usual, if you will, for these 28 days. We want to take the time out to form a fasting community that will better identify with what it's like for Iraqi people when they can't make choices to eat or to sustain themselves the way that they need to and want to. And it's been a real privilege to be with six people in Washington, D.C., accompanied by six others in other parts of the United States, and to take time every morning to reflect, to think together, to read together certain books, and then to just try and hit Washington, D.C. by storm. We're knocking on doors of Congress people constantly, going to meet with State Department representatives, having panels with some of the people in various universities, and just trying to do everything we can to be voices on behalf of the people we've met in Iraq.
And who is the we?
Well, we right now are Nick Ahrens and Bert Sachs, and they are both people who have been very instrumental in forming and developing Voices in the Wilderness. Nick working closely with me in Chicago for the past year, and Bert has recently taken a delegation of doctors from Physicians for Social Responsibility over to Iraq. Also, Ra'ed Bata, an Iraqi person who's from Kentucky. It's kind of unusual to hear this southern drawl from this big Kentucky guy, and he's Iraqi. His email address is iamaniraqi@aol.com. And Mark McGuire, who arranged my coming here earlier, he's a farmer from here in La Crosse, probably the best red farmer. I just imagine him milking a cow with one hand and reading a book in the other. An indefatigable scholar who is so touched by the plight of Iraqi people that he can't seem to stay away from this issue and from increasing action. And we also have Simon Herrick, who just returned after being in Iraq for 6 weeks. And Simon and Nick, when they were in Iraq, came back with probably one of the hardest stories I've ever heard. They went to a school in northern Iraq, a school of children, and when they went inside, the kids inside the school were so petrified that Americans were in their building that they started to scream and cry, and three mothers had to come and take their kids home because they were uncontrollably fearful. Well, just 9 days earlier, a U.S. bomb, a big, huge bomb, had exploded so near the school that all the windows in the school had crashed in on the students, and they were covered with shrapnel and broken glass. So no wonder they were so terribly frightened. So these are the kinds of stories that we need to try to get forth. And really, the other night, it was very unusual. We watched the State of the Union address together, but we sandwiched that in between listening to tapes, videotapes, of Hans von Sponeck, the director of food and medicine distribution in Iraq, telling about what his experience is. And he was so genuine, and he spoke from his heart, and he spoke without any notes, but he spoke about the plight of children and how bad the education is and how terrible it is that there's a sort of an intellectual deprivation that's going to make that country's future so very, very difficult. And when you hear that contrasted with President Clinton speaking also, I'm sure, out of a genuine desire to improve the lot of children here and make it safe for children here, but all the while he was reading from a prepared speech, I wished so much that we could have some just small notion of what it means for a person on the ground in Iraq to be trying to get the truth forth into the State of our Union here.
Explain again who Hans von Sponeck is. We've had Dennis Halliday on Democracy Now, who has been speaking around this country. He's also teaching now, but is speaking nonstop about his experiences there as head of the program there, the Oil for Food program.
And then Dennis Halliday resigned because he felt that he couldn't any longer cooperate with what he terms genocide happening in Iraq. So as an act of conscience, he resigned, and his successor is Hans von Sponeck, who is from Germany. And when I first met him in November of 1998, I suppose I walked away in Baghdad feeling, oh, well, I don't know if this person is going to ever speak out very vigorously. He said, I am going to take time out to analyze and to interpret the data, and that is my job, and I'm not going to say anything more. Well, after a year in Iraq, he has now become an impassioned speaker calling for an end to the economic sanctions. He interprets the data all right. He makes it patently clear that when there are problems with regard to distribution of food and medicine in Iraq, it ought not be attributed to malice on the part of the Iraqi government, but rather to the consequence of an infrastructure that is so destroyed and debilitated that the people, also loaded down with fatigue, simply can't accomplish efficient distribution of food and medicine. He has made it very clear that the economic sanctions are hurting civilians and that they are also in their humanitarian mission as UN workers needing to investigate the consequences of the continual bombardment. Because of that, the United States State Department has claimed that he's not a credible source for information anymore. In fact, a State Department representative told us just the other day that it would be better for the Iraqi people if he were to resign his job. Now, I find this so amazing and incredible. Not one State Department person that we've spoken to has ever been to Iraq. They won't take the United Nations reports. They selectively take reports that come from their unidentified people on the ground who are apparently telling them that the Iraqi people want the bombing to continue. I've been over there 10 times in the last 3 years. I've yet to hear anybody say that, would the United States please bomb them? It seems to me a level of misinformation and manipulation of information that runs so contrary to democracy that we really ought to be a bit frightened by it, but then not to run away from it, to confront it.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly, who is head of Voices in the Wilderness in Chicago. She has led numerous delegations to Iraq and is now in the midst of a 28-day hunger fast against the sanctions against Iraq, and is spending most of her time in Washington, D.C., while she is drinking only juice, meeting with Congress members and State Department officials. Now, what is it like to go to the State Department in your condition and given the condition of the people in Iraq right now and how long it's been?
Well, we actually felt very, I want to use the word empowered, by the meeting with the State Department official, because she really was not able to dispute any of the points that we raised, and we felt that it was pretty easy to refute most of the State Department claims that came out in a September 1999 report. And it seemed to me that if this encounter had been publicized, if it had gone public, it would have been very, very good for U.S. people to hear an exchange between people like us and people who are working now for the State Department. And I actually wondered if 40 years from now, Hans von Sponeck might be right when he says people will look back at the way that the United States has conducted foreign policy toward Iraq as a perfect case study of exactly how not to do it. And if perhaps she might sometime feel chagrin that she's being used in a policy-making situation, which is forcing her to compromise herself. And I had this same feeling when we talked with somebody who represents Middle East International, Mr. David Mack, who has been a consultant for oil companies since the beginning of the Gulf War. He's been working closely with the State Department. And he was in a panel with Dennis Halliday and me and another person working for Senator Kerry, who is pro-sanctions. And when we were at Georgetown University together, I was very, very glad that there was a group of students present who could take a look at what was being said on both sides and evaluate it, and it was pretty clear that most people walked away feeling that the case for ending the economic sanctions against Iraq was a good one. We're going to hold a blood drive at Georgetown University and ask people to come and donate the blood locally, but do so in memory of Iraqi children who have died. And we hope some Congress people will find some courage to come out and join us for that. We hope people in their districts will encourage them to go out and do that. It's a very, very small step that they could take to at least allow Iraq to come onto the radar screen, to be mentioned, and to be mentioned not in the context of seeing only one person living in the country, their president, Saddam Hussein, but seeing a whole nation of 22 million people who simply cannot be dismissed if there's ever to be Middle East peace.
You talk about the children and the number of deaths. Can you just go through the figures again?
Well, they remain so horrifying. You know, the 500,000 figure was arrived at, derived from a report that was filed in December of 1995. And then UNICEF had a press conference in October 1996 when Carol Bellamy said that 5,000 children were dying every month in Iraq. And then more recently, the United Nations released a report in August of 1999. And in that report, they used language that talked about an excess of 40,000 deaths just amongst the children under age 5. And as these statistics pile up, it seems to me as though maybe one way to understand it is that it's as though we're holding these children hostage and saying to Iraq's people, you either force your government to unconditionally surrender to every demand we make of it, or we'll slaughter these children. And if you don't believe it, check your statistics. And that's what the statistics say every single month. Hundreds of thousands of innocent people, many of them children, dying as a direct result of U.S. policy.
Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes asked Madeleine Albright if it was worth the price, 500,000 children dead. And she said, yes, it was worth the price. Has she changed her view at all?
Well, you know, in November of 1998, she said that the sanctions would never be lifted as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. Now, this is a very important line to contend with, because Iraq's government then has no incentive to comply with United Nations mandates. Now, in fact, the weapons inspectors say that Iraq is three-fourths of the way around the fifth and final lap, if you were to liken weapons inspection to a race. And Scott Ritter vehemently, emphatically says, does Iraq have chemical weapons? No. Do they have biological weapons? No. Do they have delivery systems? No. And Scott Ritter thinks the economic sanctions should be lifted. He's a former United Nations weapons inspector who resigned his job. Now, Madeleine Albright says the sanctions won't be lifted until Saddam Hussein is out of power. Well, in a way, this is telling the Iraqi government, no matter what you do, it won't end the sanctions unless you self-destruct. Now, sovereign nations seldom do that. Madeleine Albright also said at another point before the bombing of Desert Fox, she said, if we have to use force, we must. We are the indispensable nation. We stand tall. We see further than other nations. Now, this is an incredible level of arrogance. And I believe other nations around the world are not going to put up with it without beginning to wonder why ever in the world should they continue to organize themselves to be subordinate to the interests of the United States. Hans von Sponeck, talking to congressional aides who'd gone over to Iraq in August, said, using the pronoun you, second person, but meaning really all of us, he said, you are overfed on the notion that you are the sole superpower and therefore every ultimatum you issue must be obeyed. And he said, other nations will not listen. They resent this. They won't respect you. But it seems like this is a notion that's very difficult for United States people to grasp. I think we become very complacent with the idea that, yeah, we are the sole superpower and we dictate the way that other people trade with us, and if we want to take other people's precious and irreplaceable resources at cut-rate prices, we can do this.
Kathy Kelly on the 18th day of her hunger fast as we sit here in La Crosse, Wisconsin, at a local country kitchen, but she has ordered only tomato juice. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Sitting, no, not no more. I'm gonna stay right here in this fine league.